Welcome to part 4 in the Lifetime Guarantee audio series, Free from Depression. Here once again are Dr. Bill and Annabelle Gillum.
We've talked about several biblical characters who knew what it was to be depressed: Elijah, Jonah, Job, and Hezekiah. Now, Elijah had been on an emotional high for 3 straight years, and he was feared by many people. He was revered by many people. And then Jezebel threatened his life, a woman. But yeah, sure, a woman who had authority, but when she said those words to him, "I'm going to get you," he threw in the towel and headed for the boonies. Now, Satan will often try to get his hand in the pie when you have been on an emotional high, just like Elijah. He was riding the crest of success wave, wasn't he?
Uh-huh.
And then, bam, all of a sudden, he's down in the dumps. Now, how is this possible? Well, on a 1 to 10 scale, your feelings, let's say, are sitting on an 8 with, let's say, joy, or it could be anxiety.
Either.
Opposites. Mm-hmm. Good feelings or bad feelings. Now, when this is the case, you're more vulnerable to having your emotions dashed or elevated, whichever the case may be there, sharply by the circumstances that surround you.
Let me give an illustration. Let's say that your son comes in from school. He's been in a soccer game, and he's on a real emotional high because his team won, and he made the winning score. But a thoughtless remark from you can completely destroy him. For instance, "You were supposed to have cut the lawn this afternoon, not played soccer." Well, now that one statement can cause a major mood swing for your son. He can go from a euphoric high to a devastating low. We use such terms as puncturing your balloon or throwing cold water on your plans to describe such an incident. Mm-hmm. And we would call that a minor incident. But such incidents can cause real emotional problems for this young boy. And he will begin trying to find some sort of a coping mechanism for his emotions, something to ease the emotional pressure.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, the big thing today is drugs.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so let's say on a 1 to 10 scale that that boy felt euphoric at level 8 as he walked in with the news of the soccer game. And then he quickly bridged over to, let's say, a feeling of hurt or anger at level 6. Now, how can this be? That is such a vast swing there on first blush as you look at it. So it seems like he'd be less susceptible to getting depressed because, after all, he had an 8 of high here. But actually, he was more susceptible to getting depressed. It's like pouring more liquid in a glass that's already 3/4 full of water. It doesn't take nearly as much to make the glass run over, does it?
No.
Maybe at times you've been laughing and all of a sudden it turned to tears, or vice versa. How do I explain this? Well, an emotion is an emotion, although it may be a very different emotion. Back to the glass of water again. Let's say it's 3/4 full of water. Now, even though oil and water repel one another, they are both liquids. And if you try to pour a half a glass of oil in there with that water, then the glass is going to overflow.
What you're saying is that we do not have different closets for good emotions and bad emotions.
They're just emotions.
They're just emotions.
Yeah.
And they don't go with joy to anger. Just as you said, it will run the glass over,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
So Elijah slid into depression when Jezebel made her remark to him.
Yeah, and I don't know that he slid.
He probably plummeted, didn't he?
He headed for the boonies.
And then we talked about Jonah and what brought on his depression. And very often we, too, will get depressed with the same sort of thoughts that Jonah had. When things don't turn out the way we expected them to turn out. And I'm going to be the brunt of this episode, not turning out the way I wanted it to. Then depression knocks at the door. You open it, and in he marches and sits down for an extended visit.
Mm-hmm. Now, Satan may try to get you with thoughts like he fed to Job, getting you to analyze what happened to you and giving you the conclusions that God just isn't fair, that you don't deserve what he's allowed to come into your life.
And then our last person we looked at was Hezekiah. And his depression was probably the most understandable one that we looked at. And, of course, that was his impending death, which is a very legitimate cause for depression.
Not for me. I'm ready to go, right? Well, in all of these, we've seen that thoughts are the pathway to depression. With Elijah, he accepted thoughts of fear from the devil. Jonah accepted thoughts of humiliation and anger. Job accepted thoughts of self-justification. Hezekiah accepted thoughts of self-pity.
Well, now let me ask you something. You're saying that Elijah accepted thoughts and Jonah accepted thoughts. What are you talking about when you say he accepted?
The power of appropriating your true identity in Christ is that because you know that the old man died and is non-existent, that these thoughts have got to be coming from someplace else, and they're served up to us by Satan with first-person singular pronouns according to the ways we used to think. And so if we grab onto those thoughts, then we're in Satan's grasp, and he'll lead us right down one of these thought paths to depression.
But we do not generate
those
thoughts. That's
right. Check out Romans 7, verses 21 to 23, and you'll see very clearly that there is a power in your body that wars against your mind, and that war takes place with first-person pronouns.
And if you, as you're listening, if you're not understanding that, I would like to suggest that you get Bill's book, Lifetime Guarantee, which really gives you insight into where these thoughts come from and how they can so devastate us. Well, let's look at another biblical character, probably one that is much better known, and that's Paul. He knew about depression. He confesses to us that he has been depressed. But the neat thing about it is that Paul gives us the way out too. Let's look first at his transparency about his depression. He says in 2 Corinthians chapter 7, verses 5 and 6, "For even when we came into Macedonia, our flesh had no rest. We were afflicted on every side, conflicts without and fears within."
And in 2 Corinthians 1, 8 through 10, I'm going to change these pronouns to I here. "For I don't want you to be unaware, brethren, of my affliction which came to me in Asia, that I was burdened excessively beyond my strength, so that I despaired even of life."
Now that's his confession. Let's finish those verses now and look at Paul's solution to his problem. The first group of scriptures, he finishes by saying, "But God, who comforts the depressed." Did you hear that?
Mm-hmm.
He comforts the depressed. "Comforted us by the coming of Titus." Now, I'm sure that Paul had been praying. I'm confident that they had been sitting around talking about their difficulties. What did God use to lift them out of their despair? How did he comfort them? He sent them a person. He sent them Titus.
Yeah. Now, God will very often do this to you in answer to your prayers. He'll send somebody to comfort you. Now, you got to receive that as from God, not just that they happened by. And Satan will tell some of you that your prayers really didn't work, that the person responded instead of God, that God never really answers your prayers, but people they take the place of God. Not so. God sends those comforters to you.
Right. Okay, and the other verses end this way. "In order that we should not trust in ourselves, but in God who raises the dead."
Boy, that's powerful. Not trust in myself,
right,
but in God.
"Who delivered us from so great a peril of death and will deliver us. He on whom we have set our hope, and he will yet deliver us. Now, it's like you said, the starting point is this. We should not trust in ourselves.
Paul says we have a powerful God. He raises the dead. He says, I look back and remember what he's done in my life, and I know something about him. He's taken care of me before. He has proven his power and his love and his wisdom. He's done it before. He's able to do it again. I'm looking to God. He's my hope. He knows my needs. I trust him to do as he thinks best for me. And furthermore, he says, if he doesn't deliver me out of this mess, I'm confident that his grace is going to be sufficient for me. Paul then shows us how to overcome. He chooses to set his mind on this. Now, Annabelle, was it that he felt all this?
No, it's that he chose to do that in spite of his feelings. He had to choose to listen to Titus. Titus was God's instrument for encouraging Paul. He was to extend God's comfort. Remember, God said he would send comfort. Titus was the answer to Paul's prayer. God kept his word. God always keeps his word.
And he'll keep his word to you. Today we're going to discuss a self-life pattern, self-destruction, or suicide. I want to read you some excerpts from a letter that I got from a young woman. I can't stand living anymore. For an eternity, it seems, I've done little but exist. I'm of no use to anyone, especially God. There's so much in my head that I know he wants me to do for myself, but I just seem incapable of willing myself to do anything, especially about my mental state. Suicide seems to be the only solution left. I'm sure people won't understand. They'll think it was senseless to waste such a young life. That's exactly how I feel. It is senseless. But since I am wasting my life anyway, I might as well do something. I'll do the only thing that I believe I can do. Stop living. Do you see why suicide is my only alternative? What would you do? Where would you go if you didn't know how to help yourself? What would you do to stop feeling so helpless? To stop feeling like such a failure for not being the Christian you know Christ wants you to be? What would you do? What would you do if year after miserable year, you only seemed to take up space? Space no one seemed to care about or notice anyway. I could commit suicide and literally not be discovered for weeks, maybe months. Christ said I was to be the light of the world. My light has been reduced to a flicker. In fact, it's worse than flickering. It's now smoking from having just been blown out. What a waste. Is there any hope? Christians would say yes. They'd point to a relationship with Jesus, and I would agree. If I could only see it again. If I could only feel it again.
And you know, about a year later, we got another letter from this young woman. Only she had discovered an amazing truth. And that is that you can die and still live.
That's right. You can die and stay here.
Right.
Yeah. And she got this by listening to our Victorious Christian Living teaching.
The beautiful truth of Galatians 2:20. I have been crucified with Christ. I have died. And yet, I live.
Yeah.
But it's not I who am living. It's Christ living in me.
Yeah.
The person who has suicidal thoughts, who commits suicide, is trying through this one dark act to communicate to his world one of several things. Number one, perhaps he's trying to communicate this. I'm tired. I'm just too tired to go on. Or perhaps I needed help and there wasn't anyone to help me. Or you'll be sorry. When I'm gone, everybody will be sorry. Or I'm alone. Why not? Or there is absolutely no other way out of the mess that I'm in. Or God wasn't there when I needed him most.
You know, you mentioned that there's no other way out. The biggest mistake that Judas made wasn't denying Christ and betraying him. It was committing suicide instead of going to Christ and saying, oh God, forgive me.
Mm-hmm. There was a way out.
There was a way out.
Mm-hmm. But all of these things reek with futility, hopeless, empty, hollow, useless, unimportant, in vain, unsuccessful, no purpose. This person has evaluated his life and has said, why go on? And then has answered his own question and said, no reason. I choose, therefore, not to go on.
So it's the ultimate self-life coping mechanism, it seems, here on planet Earth. I don't have to see her anymore. I can finally rest. I don't have to face tomorrow. I don't have to carry this load anymore.
Mm-hmm. As we have discussed before, suicidal thoughts were one of my big patterns,
Yeah. One
of my coping mechanisms. Here's an excerpt from my diary. Let me share it with you. My thoughts, how very, very far I am from being the person God intends for me to be. Never have I been so tempted to just give up. I dislike myself, my whole being, so intensely. I've prayed to be a spiritual wife for so long, and I'm not, and I don't know what else to do or not to do. I know that you are willing and able, God, so there's something within me that blocks your power. How heartsick I am. Never has my love for my husband been so frail. I'm falling more and more into the habit of judging him, of evaluating him, of allowing him to cause me unrest and irritation. How I long for someone that I can feel comfortable with, someone in whom I could confide. I have reached the point of complete failure. How ridiculous it is for me to teach, to counsel, to be looked upon as a godly woman. For those who know me best, those who live with me, know what I am. And the words are so hollow and meaningless when they see me day after miserable day. Therefore, I will not teach. I will not have a Bible study. I will not counsel. I am basically a very unhappy person. And Lord, I want to blame you, for I so long to be filled with you and your beauty. But these are my feelings. And this is the truth. I am utterly defeated, completely discouraged. I have no friends, no joy, no compassion, no hope. Signed, Annabelle Gill.
How awesome, doll, is God's grace. And when I think of the role that I had in driving you to such a point of frustration, I just can't think about such things.
God's grace.
But God's awesome grace that he would take two people, very committed Christians, from what you've described there, and begin to turn it around through what we're teaching on this program, Lifetime Guarantee. Wow. Well, you can read the newspaper and you can find out who, when, how, why folks take their lives. But you find very little written that says, well, why not? Well, let's go to God's Word. The first reason in God's Word that I can see is 1 Corinthians 3:16, which says,
if any man destroys the temple of God, and that's your earth suit, God will destroy him. For the temple of God is holy, and that is what you are. You're holy. There's your true identity in Christ. So I don't know what that means there, but that ain't the good news that God says, I will destroy him. I'm not sure. I don't know what that means, but it's bad. I know that. Listen, you don't belong to yourself. You have been bought with a price. You have no more right to kill yourself than you have to kill your neighbor. You don't own yourself anymore. It's like you sold an automobile, and then the guy began to have trouble with it, and so you saw it stalled out along the freeway, and you stopped your car, and you went over there, and you took out a tire tool and just started smashing that car to pieces. And the guy comes up with the wrecker, and he says, what are you doing to my car? Well, I'm smashing it up. It's not worth anything. I wish I'd never sold it to you. And he said, listen, you stop that. You have no right to hit that car. That's my car. I bought it. For a price. And it's the same way with a Christian, isn't it?
Absolutely. No right.
Yeah.
Okay, the number two reason on why not commit suicide, very simple, it's murder. Exodus chapter 20, verse 13 says, you shall not murder. Well, why not? Maybe this person that we're contemplating murdering is a useless, irritating person who just causes grief to everyone around him or her. Everyone would really be better off without him, right?
Mm-hmm.
Wrong. That is not the way to solve the problem.
That's right.
How do we know that God is finished with that person? How do we know what God has in store for him, that useless, no good, irritating person that's causing you and everyone around him nothing but grief? Listen, God isn't finished with him yet. What right do I have to step in and stop God's work?
Mm-hmm.
You see, what I'm communicating is this. Let's give up on this one, God. Past redemption. I really don't think you can do anything with him. He's the world's worst, as far as I'm concerned.
You're talking about Saul of Tarsus.
Uh-huh.
You would have done God a favor to kill him, you would have thought.
But God would have said the same thing. Hey, wait, I'm not finished with him yet. And that's what God is saying about you. That's what God was saying about me.
Yeah.
Not that I have become something splendid, but oh, the miraculous life that I have now, simply because I hung around long enough to work his plan in my life. Now, that note that I read was written in 1972. I had been a Christian for 32 years, but all I knew about the Christian life was that I was saved. Oh, I would have missed out on so much, wouldn't I? At 4:30 on a Friday afternoon, she ended her life. She was deceived. And in this world, her lips are still, silenced not by God, but by her own hand. No more to sing with joy, blending her voice with all of God's creation in praise. No more to shout, listen to me, world, I've found him. No more to whisper words of love to that one who loved her so very much, Jesus. In this world, her eyes no longer see, blinded to the tiny yellow buttercup, to the still dawn of a slumbering day, to the azure blue of a cloudless sky, and the thousand eyes of a starry night. Unable to see the gifts of love sent by the eternal lover of her soul, Jesus. No longer to hear in this world, for she listened, not to God and his myriad sounds of love, but to a voice wooing her to sink, to submit, to suicide. That one sin of rebellion from which we cannot turn and say, I'm sorry.
This week we're talking about a pattern, a self pattern, a self-life pattern. And it's a self-destruct pattern, isn't it, Sugar?
Mm-hmm.
And we've been talking about why it's wrong for a person to kill himself. Yesterday we pointed out that suicide was wrong for a couple of reasons. Number one, your body is the temple of God. And he says in 1 Corinthians 3:16, if any man destroys the temple of God, God will destroy him. For the temple of God is holy, and that is what you are. So I have no right to do that, do I?
No.
And secondly, we pointed out that suicide is murder, and murder is a sin. It's a deliberate disobedience to the God who said, you shall not murder. You don't belong to yourself. You've been bought with a price. The price was Jesus Christ. And you're no more justified in killing yourself than you are in killing your neighbor or in killing the president. So today we're going to continue. Why is it wrong? Why not go ahead and do it? Why not kill myself? So reason number three that I cannot suicide is because of the motive behind suicide. The motive is not Jesus Christ. It is not of God. It's the flesh. And the motive is revenge, perhaps, or anger, or hatred, disillusionment, depression. And none of those are the life of Christ through me,
mm-hmm.
are they?
No. Looking at those, well, anger is the foundation
That's
for
right.
many of those. Either anger at myself, mm-hmm. anger at someone else, anger at God.
I'd say it's the foundation for all of them.
Mm-hmm. But thoughts such as these against a lover, against a parent, well, against the world in general.
Or God.
Or God.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. She'll be sorry when she finds out. Or I'll get even with them. I'll show them. Or I hate you so much that I'm willing to hurt myself to prove it to you. Or disillusionment. I had so hoped it would be different. I thought I could do it. Or depression. I've given it my best, but I just can't do it. I'll never amount to anything. I give up. And what you are doing, you are rejecting the whole world and everyone that's in it. You are doing to the world what you have condemned the world for doing to you,
mm-hmm.
rejecting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Hatred of yourself. Thoughts like this, I've done it all wrong. What a mess I've made out of things. I hate myself more than anyone or anything in the world. I hate myself. And what do you do when you hate so intensely for so long? You strike out. You want to hurt that person, do away with that person. And so you center all of this hostility on yourself.
I really never realized, and I don't think people do, how all during those years when I was suicidal, just how self-centered I was. Oh, now, of course, you try to reason things out. You think, well, they'll be better off without me.
It's for their good.
It's for their good.
Mm-hmm.
Or I'm just really an unlovely, unlovable person in the whole world. Would be better off without me. Now, that's not being self-centered, is it?
Doesn't sound like it.
But it is, because you see, what I'm doing is I'm making a decision for everybody else. Who am I to tell you what's best for you? Who am I to take my life and in so doing take a mother away from her daughter, to take a dad away from his son and say, oh, you'd be better off without me?
Mm-hmm.
To take a wife away from her husband. You see, you really don't know what's best for you, and I've got to make that decision for you. I think I know best.
and the pain is left behind as a result of that. Many relatives or friends will be thrown into deep introspection, searching for years, asking, why did they do that? What could I have done to stop him or her? Was he trying to tell me something and I just didn't hear? I just wasn't listening. I was too busy. Didn't she know how much I needed her and how much I loved her?
And number five, why not? Why you should not commit suicide? Well, the image that you leave behind. You know, when you really think about it, what kind of person do we all admire, generally speaking? Well, for instance, Jimmy Stewart, and It's a Wonderful Life. Just keeps escalating every Christmas, you know. We admire Jimmy Stewart.
Yeah. They run it every Christmas,
yeah,
don't they?
Alan Ladd in Shane. The unsinkable Molly Brown. The down-and-out person who makes a comeback. The physically impaired person who says, look out, world, here I come. The person who says, hey, I'm coming home. It's going to be all right. The brave, the tenacious, the courageous, the undaunted. A person who commits suicide is claiming, I feel things more deeply than just the common person. But what we hear the person who commits suicide saying is this: everyone else may be able to face it, but I can't face it.
Yeah. Which brings to mind Ernest Hemingway's statement a few weeks before he suicided. He said to a friend, what does a man care about? Staying healthy, enjoying your work, eating and drinking with friends, enjoying sex, and I haven't any of them. And here he was, 62 years old. He had burned his life out in a life of rebellion. And he committed the one final act of rebellion that is supposed to be reserved for God. And that is, when I'm going to die.
Mm-hmm. And you see, what I hear Hemingway saying there, or what it says to me, I'm sure he was trying to communicate the thought, well, I feel things more deeply. I've had such a good life, such a robust life. I choose not to live without it. But what I hear him saying is this: sure, everybody gets old and sick, and sure, there are a lot of people whose minds begin to play tricks on them, and sure, there are millions of people who get to the place where they can't do the things they've always done, you know, live the life of gusto and pleasure. I know that, and they face it, but I can't. The little old lady in the nursing home can.